it without the computer. It would have been impossible. Much as I hate to admit to something like that, I expect Abe is probably right. His memory's pretty good about why I was at that conference, too. I wanted to show him my books, and I wanted to ask him about merchandise control. But I knew I'd never be any whiz-bang computer guy myself, so I had another reason for going to that school. I was looking to hire a good, bright systems person, and I figured I might find one there. As it happened, there were all sorts of bright people in that school. Dale Warman, a very astute retailer from the Fred Meyer Company out in Portland, and now a good friend, was there, as was Arlie Lazarus, who became president of Herb Fisher's Jamesway Corporation. And, of course, that's where I first met Ron Mayer, then the smart young chief financial officer at Duckwall Stores in Abilene, Kansas. I targeted him as the guy we needed at Walmart and started wooing him right there. Like so many of them, he wasn't interested just then in moving to Bentonville, Arkansas, to work for somebody he knew next to nothing about. Later on, we changed his mind. But I had another problem on my mind when I went up there. Distribution. All these other guys, like Abe Marks, were in large urban markets, and their stores were being supplied by big distributors. Kmart and Woolco were using the same distribution system that was supplying their thousands of variety stores. So here we were out in the sticks with nobody to distribute to our stores, which meant basically that our managers would order from salesmen, and then some day or other a truck from somewhere would come along and drop off the merchandise. Even at the stage we were in, this was totally unworkable. A lot of our stores weren't big enough to order whole pallets of merchandise, so we had rented that old garage in downtown Bentonville as our warehouse. We would have big shipments delivered there, then unpack them and repack them into smaller quantities. Then we'd call the truck lines to come get them and take them to the stores. It was expensive and inefficient. Somewhere in that period, Farrell and I had hired another fellow from Newberry's, Bob Thornton, who had been running a distribution center for them in Omaha, with the promise that we were going to build a distribution center for him to run. Bob Thornton. He hired me with the full understanding that I was going to put together a warehouse and distribution system. I accepted the job, moved down here, and started drawing some plans. Then one day he proceeds to tell me he doesn't know for sure whether we really need a warehouse yet or not. It upset me to no end because that was really the only field I wanted to be into. I said, "Gee, Sam, I want to run a warehouse." For about 6 months to a year there, I just worked during various things around the company, and in my spare time I drew up plans for a distribution center. There wasn't room for me in the office, so they knocked a hole through the wall and went into the upstairs of the shoe store next door. It was kind of like an attic, my office, with no heat or air conditioning in it. We had one old toilet for a restroom with a screen door hook on the door. And there were about 25 people working there by now. Sam would come by every so often and tell me to keep working on drawing those warehouse plans, but I could see he wasn't sure about it at all. I knew we needed a warehouse. I just wanted to make sure we got the kind we needed. And at this time, too, remember, we were financing everything ourselves. We were borrowing heavily to open new stores. But anyway, there was one guy at that same IBM school, a fellow up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, who was the only one who had a warehouse, a distribution center. He invited me to go look at it. So when I got home from the school, I drew Don Whitaker and Farrell and Bob Thornton and some other folks, there were six of us, I remember, into a Beechcraft Baron I was flying in those days, and hauled us up to Green Bay, Wisconsin. We went through this warehouse, saw how they did it, took a lot of notes on everything. It was computerized, one of the first computerized warehouses I know anything about. After that trip, I knew we had to build one. and everybody was pressuring me for a new general office, so we bought 15 acres on a farm right outside Bentonville, where we still are today, for about $25,000. Bob was in charge of building us a new 15,000-foot general office, which I thought would last us forever, and a 60,000-foot warehouse, which I thought was too big, but Farrell convinced me we needed it. Bob Thornton. As I recall, my blueprint for the warehouse called for 100,000 square feet, which to me was very minimal. Then Sam decided to get an architect involved. When I got to look at the drawing, I thought, well, this can't be right. It's only 60,000 square feet. So I went to tell Sam about it, and he said, well, I called the architect and told him to cut it back. I just don't think we need that 100,000 square feet, Bob. Another thing, I had designed that distribution center around an in-floor tow line system. You know, a track that moves carts around the floor. Sam says, well, Bob, I just don't think we can do that. We can't spend that kind of money. At that point, I literally didn't know how to run a warehouse without one, so I just said, hey, Sam, if we don't have a tow line system, then you don't need me, because I don't know what to do without it. So he gave in to that. The truth is, Sam never did anything in size or volume until he actually had to. He always played it close to the belt. It's true enough that I was nervous about spending any unnecessary money in those days. We were generating as much financing for growth as we could from the profits of the stores, but we were also borrowing everything we could. I was taking on a lot of personal debt to grow the company. It approached $2 million, which was a lot of money at the time. The debt was beginning to weigh on me. By now, I no longer had any doubt that we were really on to something. We had expanded to Missouri. Sykeston was our first store there, and we'd put stores in Neosho and West Plains. We'd gone to Claremore, Oklahoma, Helen's hometown. Our first 7 or 8 Walmarts were showing spectacular results. Once we got it going, it was hard to see why we should quit. The thing was, you could see the potential so clearly. The profits and the sales were there, but we needed to get better organized and come up with a more sensible way to finance the growth. I needed someone to help me with systems and distribution. I had stayed in touch with Ron Mayer, and I kept after him to work for us. Finally, I talked him into coming down to look over our operations, and then darn near killed him before he ever had a chance to sign on. We were flying around in my Beach Baron looking at stores, and we were on our way in to land at Carthage, Missouri, headed for store number 12. There are 2 intersecting runways at Carthage, and as I touched down on one of them, all of a sudden up ahead, we saw this plane on the other runway right at the intersection, and we were headed straight at him. I hadn't seen him or heard him on the radio. I didn't know where he came from. I gave that Baron all the power it had, and we just barely made it over the top of the other plane. Then we circled around and landed. This was Ron's first trip with me, and who knows what he must have thought. But somehow I talked him into coming to work with us anyway. He joined Walmart in 1968 as Vice President for Finance and Distribution. Even though it may surprise some people, I have to say that I consider the time Ron was at the company from 1968 until 1976, when he left under some fairly unpleasant circumstances for both of us, to be the most important period of development in Walmart's history. We had a good thing going before Ron arrived, but he and some of the people he brought on board, like Royce Chambers, our first data processing manager, gave the company its first sophisticated systems. And those systems were the beginnings of a management method which allowed us to stay real close to our stores even as our growth exploded. We were forced to be ahead of our time in distribution and in communication because our stores were sitting out there in tiny little towns, and we had to stay in touch and keep them supplied. Ron started the programs that eventually improved our in-store communication system, building on the groundwork already laid by Ferrolt Arend. Ron also took over distribution and began to design and build a system that would enable us to grow as fast as we could come up with the money. He was the main force that moved us away from the old drop shipment method, in which a store ordered directly from the manufacturer and had the merchandise delivered directly to the store by a common carrier. He pushed us in some new directions, such as merchandise assembly, in which we would order centrally for every store and then assemble their orders at the distribution center, and also cross-docking, in which pre-assembled orders for individual stores would be received on one side of our warehouse and leave out the other. From Ron Mayer's arrival on, we as a company have been ahead of most other retailers in investing in sophisticated equipment and technology. The funny thing is, everybody at Walmart knows that I've fought all these technology expenditures as hard as I could. All these guys love to talk about how I never wanted any of this technology and how they had to lay down their life to get it. The truth is, I did want it. I knew we needed it. But I just couldn't bring myself to say, okay, sure, spend what you need. I always questioned everything. It was important to me to make them think that maybe the technology wasn't as good as they thought it was, or that maybe it really wasn't the end-all they promised it would be. It seems to me they try just a little harder and check into things a little bit closer if they think they might have a chance to prove me wrong. If I really hadn't wanted the technology, I wouldn't have sprung the money loose to pay for it. By the late 60s, we were really well positioned for serious growth. We had a retail concept we believed in, the core of a professional management team, and the foundations of systems which would support growth. In 1968, we had 14 variety stores and 13 Walmarts. In 1969, we had 14 variety stores and 18 Walmarts. And we were raring to go. I couldn't resist taking that next step to see how far we could go. And I always figured we would slow down or stop when we weren't as profitable as we should be. It was around that time that Bud and I, very quietly, began to think about taking the company public. Chapter 7. Taking the Company Public. A quote from Al Miles, first assistant manager, store number 6, Fayetteville, Arkansas, now a retired Walmart executive. When we went on the stock market, it didn't mean anything to some of us country boys. The chairman always said I came across the Red River barefooted and hunting a job, which is almost the way it was. I didn't even know what stock was, but I bought some, thank God, because Phil Green said, hey, you buy some of that stock, boy. I bought it, and I kept it, because I believed in Mr. Walton, and I believed in my store. It's real simple. I believed him when he said we could do all these things with the company, and we did. From the time I took out my first bank loan, the $1,800 to buy that ice cream machine for the Ben Franklin down in Newport, I was never really comfortable with debt, but I recognized it as a necessity of doing business. And I had gotten pretty good at accumulating it. For a while, I would just go down to the local bank and borrow whatever I could to build a store or buy something we needed to grow the business. That practice had got me in debt to practically every bank in Arkansas and southern Missouri. They believed in what we had done up to that point, and they believed we would pay them off. I always did pay them off on time. But sometimes I would borrow from one to pay the other. I had bought a bank in Bentonville for about $300,000, just a little old bank with only about $3.5 million in deposits. but it really helped me learn a lot about financing things. I made some new acquaintances and began to study more about bankers and how they like to do business. I struck up a relationship with a guy named Jimmy Jones at Republic Bank down in Dallas, and he loaned us $1 million. And, of course, I had tried all along to attract some equity investment from our store managers and a few relatives. So by 1970, we had 78 partners invested in our company, which really wasn't one company, but 32 different stores owned by a combination of different folks. My family owned the lion's share of every store, but Helen and I were also in debt up to our eyeballs, several $1 million worth. I never dwell on the negative, but that debt weighed heavy on me. If something happened and everybody decided to call their notes, I kept thinking, we would be sunk. Maybe that's what being raised in the Depression does to you, but I wanted out of that debt in the worst way. I had talked a little bit about the idea of taking the company public, seeking advice from people like Abe Marks and some of those other discounters in that association we all belong to, but I really hadn't pursued anything seriously. One day in 1969, we got a call from Mike Smith, who said he wanted to come up and talk to us. Mike worked for Witt and Jack Stevens in Little Rock. Today, Stevens, Inc., is the largest investment banking firm west of the Mississippi, and one of the most respected in the country. Back then, it was mostly a bond house. Now, Jack, by the way, was the fellow who had come in and successfully developed that Little Rock shopping center after I failed. So Mike Smith drove up to Bentonville. We were still in those old three rooms of offices over the lawyer's office and the barbershop on the square. I remember Mike climbing those stairs. He's a bit of a renegade himself. He has a lot of original ideas. And during our conversation that day, he planted the seed that maybe we really were doing well enough to go public. That is, to issue stock in the company and sell it to the public. Mike Smith, Stevens, Inc. I went up there to see them in the fall of 1969, and it was really the height of ambition. We had only done one public offering, and I had done it, so I thought I was an expert. Sam was eager to talk because he had borrowed all the money he possibly could. I stopped at every Walmart between Little Rock and Bentonville so I would know something about his stores. Of course, the first thing he did was throw me in that plane of his and fly us all over Oklahoma and Missouri looking at stores. Not long after that, Bud and I went quail hunting up on the Robson Ranch in Oklahoma, and the hunting was really good. We spent most of the day talking about our options. We wanted to expand, and we realized we weren't generating enough profits both to expand and to pay off our debts. In fact, our cash shortage had forced us to give up 5 land sites, where we had already planned to build new stores, so we knew we had to do something. Driving back that night, we agreed to seriously explore the possibilities of going public. It was a huge step for us, and we were concerned about losing control of the company. My son Rob had graduated from Columbia University Law School the year before and had gone to work at the biggest law firm in Tulsa. We, the Walton family, were his first client. As our lawyer, he also kept track of the various Walmart store partnership agreements, so I asked him to start looking at all our options. We still weren't sure we could take the company public. Meanwhile, money was getting tight, and some of our creditors were pressuring us. I flew to Dallas and tried to borrow some more from Republic Bank, whose officers were getting nervous about what they'd already loaned us. They made it clear we had all of their money we were likely to see, and that ended our relationship. By then, Jimmy Jones had moved to a bank in New Orleans, First Commerce, so I flew down there from Dallas to see if he could help us. Jimmy came up with a $1.5 million loan, which helped us out in the short term, but it really wasn't the answer to our long-term problem. For various reasons, including taxes, Rob recommended restructuring our debt, consolidating it into one big loan for the company. Ron Mayer and I had heard that the Prudential was making loans to a lot of small retail chains, so we made an appointment with one of their loan officers and flew to New York. By now, we really needed the money, pure and simple. I went to Prudential. I had my predictions all spelled out on my yellow legal pad, and I was sure they were going to loan us the money. I went through my 5-year plan, my sales, profits, number of stores, and talked about our strategy of going to the small towns where there was no competition, and told the loan officer how much business we thought there was out there waiting to be plucked. He didn't buy it at all. Told us he didn't think a company like the Prudential could afford to gamble with us. I saved those projections for a long time, and they were all exceeded by 15% to 20% in the years to come. Somehow we had a contact at another insurance company, Mass Mutual, so we went to see them. They agreed to lend us $1 million. And in turn, we agreed to give them our right arm and our left leg. We didn't just pay interest. We had to give them all sorts of stock options in case we did go public. By now, they had us over a barrel. I had no choice. We had to have the money. When we went public, they made millions and millions on that deal. But then I was tired of owing money to people I knew. And I was even more tired of begging money from strangers. I made up my mind for sure that we were going to take Walmart to the stock market. I let Mike Smith and Jack Stevens know we wanted to go ahead with the idea, but I also let them know they were going to have to compete for our business, just like I've always made everybody else compete for business with us. Also, I let them know I didn't feel comfortable going with a Little Rock firm. I thought we needed a Wall Street underwriter. Maybe that was right, and maybe it wasn't. I know Mike and Jack didn't feel too good about it. But I went running off to New York to see what I could find out. Mike Smith. Obviously, we wanted to handle the whole offering, but Sam was always one to shop around. Here's what happened the way I remember it. Sam was up in New York on a buying trip, and he decided to go down to Wall Street and hear what some of those guys had to say, just cold calling, right off the street. He knew that White Weld had taken public a retail chain called Pomida up in Omaha, so he went to visit them. He introduced himself to the receptionist as Sam Walton of Walmart Stores, like he always does, and said, "I want to talk to somebody about taking my company public." She said, "Oh, really? Where are you from?" And when he told her Bentonville, Arkansas, she said, "Well, we have a Mr. Remmel here, and he's from Arkansas. Perhaps he could help you." And she introduced him to Buck Remmel, who was from Little Rock. I don't really remember how I met Buck, but Mike might have it right. I remember introducing myself to him and saying something like, "What are the chances that you folks would be interested in backing us on this offering?" Well, he said he would look at it, and sure enough, they decided they were interested. I still think that's one reason the offer was so successful, because at the time, White Weld was one of the leading institutional investment banking firms. Not everyone around here agrees with me, but I'm sticking to my opinion. Mike Smith. Sam decided, correctly at the time, that White Weld knew more about public offerings than we did, so he let them have the business. But he told them, "I hope you'll include the folks at Stevens, because they are good friends and they're good people." White Weld asked us if we wanted to take a third of the deal to their two-thirds. I talked it over with Jack, and he asked me what I thought of the company. I said I thought we ought to do it. And we did. Later on, in other offerings, we got a 50-50 piece of the deal, along with White Weld. So Rob started to work on the plan, which was to consolidate all these partnerships into one company, and then sell about 20% of it to the public. At the time, our family owned probably 75% of the company, Bud owned 15% or so. Some other relatives owned a percentage. Charlie Baum owned some. Willard Walker owned some. Charlie Kate owned some. Claude Harris owned some. All those early managers would borrow money from our bank to buy stock in the stores. Willard was the most skillful at getting money. He would cultivate the guys who ran the banks, and they'd let him have what he wanted. Consequently, he realized fabulous returns on it. He had more ownership than any of the managers. Rob Walton. Dad had a spreadsheet listing all the minority ownerships in the various companies, and the problem was figuring out on what basis to value them all for the initial offering. As I recall, we basically proposed using book value. We did not do any kind of sophisticated relative evaluation of the companies, which would have taken into account earnings and growth projections and all that sort of stuff. But everybody signed right up, and as far as I know, everybody's happy today with the way it worked out. We were all ready to go at the beginning of 1970, and Ron Mayer and I did a dog and pony show all over the place. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, telling everybody how great we were going to be. But before we got the stock issued, the market fell out on us, and we had to postpone the offering. We were already having unusual managers' meetings in those days. We would all go fishing together without wives for 4 or 5 days at a time and talk about the business. I remember we were on one of those trips to Table Rock Dam, and I had to tell everybody that we were pulling back on the deal. But the market recovered some, and on October 1st, 1970, Walmart became a public company, traded over the counter. Our prospectus offered 300,000 shares at a price of $15, but it sold for $16.50. It was well received, though not widely held. We only had about 800 shareholders, most of them either institutions or folks we knew. Those who bought in that offering or who owned some of those early partnerships and had them converted in that offering made an absolute killing. As everybody today knows, Walmart's stock performance and the wealth it has created is a story in itself. Just 15 years ago, the market value of the company was around $135 million. Today, it's over $50 billion. But here's a better way to look at it. Let's say you bought 100 shares back in that original public offering for $1,650. Since then, we've had 9 2-for-1 stock splits, so you would have 51,200 shares today. Within the last year, it's traded at right under $60 a share. So your investment would have been worth right around $3 million at that price. Obviously, our stock has made a lot of folks happy over the years. And pure and simple, that's where the Walton family net worth has been created. It's paid off beyond any of our dreams. One funny memory about that public offering. The day it went through, Ron and I were leaving New York, and at the airport we met a guy from T. Rowe Price, a money management firm in Baltimore. We were so full of ourselves that somehow we made him believe we were going to do well. He went back to Baltimore and bought a pretty large share of that stock for his firm. They held it for 10 or 15 years and became the star of their industry. We would split and split, and they would sell and sell. I don't know how many millions they made on that stock. Helen Walton. I realized before we went public that I didn't want it to happen. I guess if I were going to be mad with Sam about anything, it would be over the fact that I always felt we could have gotten by without going public. Nothing about the company ever affected me as deeply. And it was at that point that I decided I had to pursue my other interests outside the company. I just hated the idea that we were going to put all our financial interests out there for everybody to see. When you go public, they can ask all kinds of questions, and the family gets involved. We just became an open book, and I hated it. Helen's right, of course, about the downside of taking the company public. It did end up bringing us a lot of unwanted attention. But coming back from New York that day, I experienced one of the greatest feelings of my life, knowing that all our debts were paid off. The Walton family only owned 61% of Walmart after that day, but we were able to pay off all those bankers, and from that day on, we haven't borrowed one dime personally to support Walmart. The company has rolled along on its own and financed itself. Going public really turned the company loose to grow, and it took a huge load off me. We had another offering later on, trying to get broader ownership of the stock so we could be traded on the New York Stock Exchange, but as a family, we've only sold very limited amounts of Walmart stock outside of those offerings. I think that has really set us apart, and as I said, that's the source of our net worth. We just kept that stock. Most families somewhere along the line would have said, "We don't want this rat race. We don't need to do what we're doing. Let somebody else have it." And then either I would have retired and backed out of the company and sold it to some Dutch investor or to Kmart or Federated or somebody like that. But I enjoyed doing what I was doing so much and seeing the thing grow and develop and seeing our associates and partners do so well that I never could quit. It was always interesting to me that except for those folks who worked in our company, our stock got very little support early on from the folks right here in Northwest Arkansas. I always had the feeling that the people around here who remembered us when we were one store and three stores, or remembered me when I was president of the Rotary or the Chamber of Commerce, somehow thought we were doing it with mirrors. They couldn't help but think we were just lucky that we could not continue long-term to do as well as we have done. I don't think it was anything peculiar to this part of the country or me or anything like that. I think it must be human nature that when somebody homegrown gets onto something, the folks around them sometimes are the last to recognize it. Like any other company, we obviously wanted to keep our stock price up and attract as many new investors as we could. And the way we went at that early on was about as unorthodox as everything else we've done. Most public companies hold annual stockholders' meetings, and many hold sessions for Wall Street stock analysts, where they tell their company story and try to drum up support for their stock. As I told you, Mike Smith is an off-the-wall guy with good ideas and suggestions that are somewhat unorthodox. So right after we went public, Mike suggested that we might want to turn our stockholders' meetings into an event, and we went along with him. Most meetings are held in some hotel ballroom in a big city and are pretty quick, formal affairs with the reading of the minutes and the passing of a few shareholder motions. A lot of them, I understand, are held in places like Wilmington, Delaware, where the companies are incorporated, in the hope that a whole lot of people won't show up. We took the opposite approach. We figured we were already out of the way enough to discourage anybody from coming, but since we wanted to encourage folks to attend, we scheduled a whole weekend of events for them. We invited folks down from New York, Chicago, or wherever. They paid their own way down and back, but we really showed them a time. Mike Smith. It's true that I came up with the idea of making the annual meeting more of an event, but Sam didn't tell you the whole reason why. I'll never forget Walmart's first annual meeting, or I should say meetings. I went up a day early to help prepare for it, but this friend of Sam's, Fred Pickens from Newport, got confused on the dates and showed up a day early. So Sam decided to go ahead and hold the meeting for Fred, right there in his office. The next day, we had the official annual meeting. Six of us met around a table of the coffee shop there by the warehouse. The next year, I said, "Sam, you're a public company, and we ought to have a real meeting and try to get some folks to come. Let's do it in Little Rock. You're from Arkansas, and Little Rock is the capital of Arkansas, and people can get there a lot easier than they can to Bentonville. He didn't like it much, but he agreed to it. So we held the second meeting at a motel, the Coachman's Inn, in Little Rock. Nobody came. And he said, "So much for your idea, Mike." Well, I was getting desperate to get some analysts down to really start following the company, so I came up with the idea of bringing them all in for a weekend at Bella Vista, which is this nice development in the hills just north of Bentonville, with lots of golf courses, tennis courts, and lakes. I still remember Sam's response to the idea when I brought it up. "Sounds like a big waste of money to me." But he decided to give it a try. It turned out to be a really good idea. These folks would come down, and we would assign a manager from the company to meet them at the airport and drive them around for the weekend. We wanted these investment types from the cities, including a lot of the bankers who were lending money to our company at the time, to see firsthand what we do and how we do it. We wanted them to get to know our managers as individuals and come to understand our company's principles. And we felt like to do that, they really had to come to Bentonville and see what kind of people we were, understand our integrity, our dedication, our work ethic, all the ingredients that were enabling us to outperform our competitors. They couldn't do that back in New York. The values and the approach of most retailers were entirely different from what this crazy bunch in Arkansas was doing, and we wanted them to see it for themselves. So they would come down, and we would have the stockholders' meeting on Friday, followed by a big picnic that night. I remember one lady wore a formal gown to one of our dinners. It got quite a few curious looks. Then we would get them up early on Saturday morning and have them come to our meeting and listen to us talk merchandising and finance and distribution, or whatever we were dealing with at the time. In the early days, it wasn't anything like what it's turned into now, which is the largest, most raucous stockholders' meeting in the world. But it was different. After the meeting on Saturday, we always had a special event. One year it was a golf tournament, which is not all that unusual, I guess. But another year we went fishing on Bull Shoals Lake. And another year we took everybody on a float trip down Sugar Creek. The wildest event I remember was when we all went camping overnight in tents on the banks of Sugar Creek. Now, that was a real fiasco. Remember now, these are a bunch of investment analysts from the big cities. Well, a coyote started howling and hoot owls hooting, and half of these analysts stayed up all night around the campfire because they couldn't sleep. We decided it wasn't the best idea to try something like this with folks who weren't accustomed to camping on the rocks in sleeping bags. Mike Smith. These get-togethers became a big hit. The Walmart folks would stay up all night barbecuing, and the analysts or other big shareholders would stay up with them to help. But after a while, things got a little out of hand for Sam's taste. Some of those Yankees got so drunk floating down Sugar Creek they couldn't stay in the boat. And some of those fellows barbecuing had a few too many beers. Well, Sam isn't a Puritan or a strict teetotaler or anything, but he can't stand for people to get drunk. So he banned alcohol completely from the events, and, of course, they were never quite the same after that. They did get a little wild for me, I guess, but if nothing else, our meetings generated a lot of talk about us back on Wall Street. Not all of it good, I'm sure. But the ones who paid attention understood that we were serious operators who were in it for the long haul, that we had a disciplined financial philosophy, and that we had growth on our minds. They also knew we liked to have fun, and a few of them probably thought maybe we were a little nuts. Those meetings are just one example of how, in the early days of being a public company, we really did have to go to greater lengths than most companies to let Wall Street get to know us and understand us. Partly that was because we operated so differently from everybody else. And partly it was because we were so isolated from New York, where a lot of folks seem to think you have to do business on the scale and size that we are. And in the process of wooing Wall Street, we met all kinds. We've been blessed and appreciated by some analysts and dismissed by others who have believed all along that we are just a house of cards waiting to fall down any second. One of our most loyal followers has been Maggie Gilliam, an analyst for First Boston, who has believed in us for years, and she's made her clients an awful lot of money by sticking to those beliefs. Here's an excerpt from a report, one of my favorites, that she wrote. Margaret Gilliam, First Boston. Walmart is the finest managed company we have ever followed. We think it is quite likely the finest managed company in America. And we know of at least one investor who thinks it is the finest managed company in the world. We do not expect to find another Walmart in our lifetime. On the other hand, I remember another analyst who came down here in the mid-70s. I'll never forget her visit. I'd been out hunting all day, and I was pretty grubby when I came in to go out to dinner with her. My son Jim, who was head of the real estate department in those days, joined us. And he was never one for dressing up. Really, he always looked pretty grubby. We took her out, and we were extremely honest with her. We told her what we felt our weaknesses were at that time, and what some of our problems were. But we tried to explain our philosophy, too, and to get her excited about all the potential we felt we had. She went back and wrote probably the darkest report on Walmart that has ever been written. The impression you got from reading it was that if you hadn't already sold your stock, it was probably too late. Over the last 10 or 15 years, most of the analysts who followed our stock have been consistent in their support, although they'll go off us temporarily for one reason or another. By and large, though, they stayed with us. I don't subscribe much to any of these fancy investing theories, and most people seem surprised to learn that I've never done much investing in anything except Walmart. I believe the folks who've done the best with Walmart stock are those who have studied the company, who have understood our strengths and our management approach, and who, like me, have just decided to invest with us for the long run. We have a group of long-time investors in Scotland who have done it better, maybe, than anybody. Back in the early days of our growth, the Stevens people took us to London, where we first attracted the interest of these folks. They told us right off that they believed in investing for the long term. They said that as long as they felt good about the basics of the company and had confidence in the management, they wouldn't be buying and selling the way many of these fund managers do. Man, they were talking my language. Years after that first trip, we visited with them in Edinburgh, and they really laid it on for us. We have a similar group out in California. And we also have an investor in France. His name is Pierre, and he's done exactly the same thing. We almost drowned him that first year we floated down Sugar Creek, and I was afraid we'd never see him again. But Pierre started believing, and he started acquiring our stock and recommending it to his French fund members. He's been with us for about 15 years, and he's had exceptionally good success with our company. Our long-term investors are happy because we have consistently rewarded them with one of the highest returns on equity in American business. From 1977 to 1987, our average annual return to investors was 46%. And even in the middle of the recession, in 1991, we reported a return on equity of more than 32%. I guess what's annoying to executives, to anybody who tries to spend their time managing a company as big as this, is these money managers who are always churning their investors' accounts. You know, the stock will get to $40 or $42, And they'll rush in there and say, hey, let's sell this thing because it's just too high. It's an overvalued stock. Well, to my mind, that doesn't make much sense. As long as we're managing our company well, as long as we take care of our people and our customers, keep our eye on these fundamentals, we are going to be successful. Of course, it takes an observing, discerning person to judge those fundamentals for himself. If I were a stockholder of Walmart, or considering becoming one, I'd go into 10 Walmart stores and ask the folks working there, how do you feel? How's the company treating you? Their answers would tell me much of what I need to know. On this same subject, I have frequently been asked if being a widely followed stock has forced us to manage differently, to think more short-term at the expense of long-term strategic planning. The answer is that we've always had to do a good bit of both. When you're opening 150 stores a year the way we do these days, a lot of your planning is necessarily short-term. But to sustain that kind of growth, you constantly have to consider what you're going to be doing 5 years out. I think that the stock market pressure has driven us to plan further out so that there will be some consistency next year and the year after, not only to our profitability, but to our operating sales, our gross margins, and those sorts of things. I've never let myself fret too much about that. We've had some tremendous fluctuations of our stock over time. Sometimes it will shoot up because retailing has become a fashionable sector with the investment community. Or it will plunge because somebody writes a report saying that Walmart's strategy is all wrong. When we bought a chain of stores called Coon's Big K in 1981, which took us east of the Mississippi for the first time in a significant way, several reports said we were taking on more than we could handle, and that we would never make it once we got to Atlanta or New Orleans. We've had reports predicting that when we get to St. Louis or wherever and met some real competition, we would never be able to stay profitable. Our demise has been predicted ever since we hit the stock market. And whenever one of these big institutional investors reads something like that and decides he believes it, he unloads 1 million shares or 500,000 shares, and in the past that has created some fluctuations in the price of our stock. Just a couple of years ago, we had some retail analysts worrying that we couldn't sustain a 20% annual growth rate because we were getting so big. At that time, I said I would be tickled to death with 20%. I mean, when we were doing $25 billion a year in sales, 20% was $5 billion, which is bigger in itself than most retailers. But these folks thought a $5 billion increase would be a disaster for us. In the meantime, look what's happened to the industry. Nowadays, we're heroes because we're still showing double-digit growth. If we do 20%, it's the lead item on the national news broadcast because they view it as an economic indicator. The point is, all those analysts may have had perfectly logical theories about why a 20% increase would be a disaster for us. But they failed to see that in a big economic downturn when everybody is suffering, Walmart's fundamental strengths would keep us going strong. And we would look great compared to everybody else. As companies get larger with a broader following of investors, it becomes awfully tempting to get into that jet and go up to Detroit or Chicago or New York and speak to the bankers and the people who own your stock. But since we got our stock jump-started in the beginning, I feel like our time is better spent with our own people in the stores, rather than off-selling the company to outsiders. I don't think any amount of public relations experts or speeches in New York or Boston means a darn thing to the value of the stock over the long haul. I think you get what you're worth. Not that we don't go out of our way to keep Wall Street up to date on what's going on with the company. For the last few years, in fact, A group called the United Shareholders Association has voted us the number one company in the U.S. based on our responsiveness to shareholders. What's really worried me over the years is not our stock price, but that we might someday fail to take care of our customers, or that our managers might fail to motivate and take care of our associates. I also was worried that we might lose the team concept, or fail to keep the family concept viable and realistic and meaningful to our folks as we grow. Those challenges are more real than somebody's theory that we're headed down the wrong path. As business leaders, we absolutely cannot afford to get all caught up in trying to meet the goals that some retail analyst or financial institution in New York sets for us on a 10-year plan spit out of a computer that somebody set to compound at such and such a rate. If we do that, we take our eye off the ball. But if we demonstrate in our sales and our earnings every day, every week, every quarter, that we're doing our job in a sound way, we will get the growth we are entitled to, and the market will respect us in a way that we deserve. Our associates and our customers, many of whom are now stockholders too, will all be better served if we perform consistently over the next 10 years, whether it is at a 15% rate, or a 20% rate, or a 25% rate. If we fail to live up to somebody's hypothetical projection for what we should be doing, I don't care. It may knock our stock back a little, but we're in it for the long run. We couldn't care less about what is forecast or what the market says we ought to do. If we listened very seriously to that sort of stuff, we never would have gone into small-town discounting in the first place. Chapter 8. Rolling Out the Formula. A quote from Jack Shoemaker, former president and COO of Walmart. Sam hired me in 1970 as district manager in charge of new store openings. He had 18 Walmarts and some variety stores doing about $31 million a year. I moved my family, and as the van was unloading the furniture into our rented house, they called from the office and said, "Can you go set up this new store in Missouri?" My wife, who had three babies and a moving van to deal with, helped me find some clothes, and I left. I didn't see her again for 2 weeks. Then there was a manager's meeting, so I didn't see her for two more weeks. It would be safe to say that in those days we all worked a minimum of 16 hours a day. Jack Shoemaker, former president and COO of Walmart. Now that we were out of debt, we could really do something with our key strategy, which was simply to put good-sized discount stores into little one-horse towns, which everybody else was ignoring. In those days, Kmart wasn't going to towns below 50,000, and even Gibson's wouldn't go to towns much smaller than 10,000 or 12,000. We knew our formula was working even in towns smaller than 5,000 people, and there were plenty of those towns out there for us to expand into. When people want to simplify the Walmart story, that's usually how they sum up the secret of our success. Oh, they went into small towns when nobody else would. And a long time ago, when we were first being noticed, a lot of folks in the industry wrote us off as a bunch of country hicks who had stumbled onto this idea by a big accident. Maybe it was an accident, but that strategy wouldn't have worked at all if we hadn't come up with a method for implementing it. That method was to saturate a market area by spreading out, then filling in. In the early growth years of discounting, a lot of national companies with distribution systems already in place, Kmart, for example, were growing by sticking stores all over the country. Obviously, we couldn't support anything like that. But while the big guys were leapfrogging from large city to large city, they became so spread out and so involved in real estate and zoning laws and city politics that they left huge pockets of business out there for us. Our growth strategy was born out of necessity, but at least we recognized it as a strategy pretty early on. We figured we had to build our stores so that our distribution centers or warehouses could take care of them, but also so those stores could be controlled. We wanted them within reach of our district managers and of ourselves here in Bentonville, so we could get out there and look after them. Each store had to be within a day's drive of a distribution center, so we would go as far as we could from a warehouse and put in a store. Then we would fill in the map of that territory, state by state, county seat by county seat, until we had saturated that market area. We saturated Northwest Arkansas. We saturated Oklahoma. We saturated Missouri. We went from Neosho to Joplin to Monette and Aurora to Nevada and Belton to Harrisonville and then on to Fort Scott and Olathe in Kansas and so on. Sometimes we would jump over an area, like when we opened store number 23 in Ruston, Louisiana, and we didn't have a thing in South Arkansas, which is between us and Ruston. So then we started backfilling South Arkansas. In those days, we didn't really plan for the future. We just felt like we could keep rolling these stores out this way, and they would keep working in Tennessee or Kansas or Nebraska, wherever we decided to go. But we did try to think ahead some when it came to the cities. We never planned on actually going into the cities. What we did instead was build our stores in a ring around a city pretty far out and wait for the growth to come to us. That strategy worked practically everywhere. We started early with Tulsa, putting stores in Broken Arrow and Sand Springs. Around Kansas City, we built in Warrensburg, Belton, and Grandview on the Missouri side of town, and in Bonner Springs and Leavenworth across the river in Kansas. We did the same thing in Dallas. This saturation strategy had all sorts of benefits beyond control and distribution. From the very beginning, we never believed in spending much money on advertising, and saturation helped us to save a fortune in that department. When you move like we did from town to town in these mostly rural areas, word of mouth gets your message out to customers pretty quickly without much advertising. When we had 75 stores in Arkansas, 75 in Missouri, 80 in Oklahoma, whatever, people knew who we were. And everybody except the merchants who weren't discounting looked forward to our coming to their town. By doing it this way, we usually could get by with distributing just one advertising circular a month instead of running a whole lot of newspaper advertising. We've never been big advertisers, and relative to our size today, we still aren't. Just like today, we became our own competitors. In the Springfield, Missouri area, for example, we had 40 stores within 100 miles. When Kmart finally came in there with 3 stores, they had a rough time going up against our kind of strength. So for the most part, we just started repeating what worked, stamping out stores cookie-cutter style. The only decision we had to make was what size format to put in what market. We had 5 different store sizes running from about 30,000 to 60,000 square feet, and we would hardly ever pass up any market because it was too small. I had traveled so much myself looking at competitors in the variety store business that I had a good feel for the kind of potential in these communities. Bud and I knew what we wanted in the way of locations. Like so many of the ideas that have made our company work from the beginning, we're still more or less following this same strategy, although today we've moved into some cities outright. But I think our main real estate effort should be directed at getting out in front of expansion and letting the population build out to us. Just like in the beginning, we start around these small towns, people drive past our stores, get to know us, and become customers. The amazing thing to me is how quickly it works. We have created so many new friends down in Florida. Yankee friends, folks who live up north, who see our stores in Florida while they're down there for the winter, and they can't wait for us to get up there. Believe it or not, I get letters all the time asking us to put a store in someplace up north because our customers miss us when they go back home. It's the same way in the Rio Grande Valley. All the farmers from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota go down there for the winter and get to know us. So we are pre-sold almost when we go into some of these areas that are new for us. We're still spreading out and filling in, and we've got a heck of a long way to go before we saturate territory which we consider to be basically friendly to Walmart. There's no question whatsoever that we could not have done what we did back then if I hadn't had my airplanes. I bought that first plane for business, to travel between the stores and keep in touch with what was going on. But once we started really rolling out the stores, the airplane turned into a great tool for scouting real estate. We were probably 10 years ahead of most other retailers in scouting locations from the air, and we got a lot of great ones that way. From up in the air, we could check out traffic flows, see which way cities and towns were growing, and evaluate the location of the competition, if there was any. Then we would develop our real estate strategy for that market. I loved doing it myself. I'd get down low, turn my plane up on its side, and fly right over a town. Once we had a spot picked out, we'd land, go find out who owned the property, and try to negotiate the deal right then. That's another good reason I don't like jets. You can't get down low enough to really tell what's going on, the way I could in my little planes. Bud and I picked almost all our sites that way until we grew to about 120 or 130 stores. I was always proud of our technique and the results we got. I guarantee you not many principals of retailing companies were flying around sideways studying development patterns. But it worked really well for us. Until we had 500 stores, or at least 400 or so, I kept up with every real estate deal we made and got to view most locations before we signed any kind of commitment. A good location, and what we have to pay for it, is so important to the success of a store. And it's one area of the company in which we've always had family involvement. Jim did it for a while. And even today, Rob goes on real estate trips and attends every real estate meeting. Once we found a good location, we just got after it and put up a store there. We built our own fixtures then, and we still do today. We had what we called a store opening plan. But basically, we would call in the troops. Usually, we called in all the available assistant managers and put together a store. I'll bet a guy like Al Miles has put together 100 stores and been to over 300 store openings. We had to assemble the fixtures, order the merchandise, and plan the advertising, not to mention hiring and training the folks to run the store. We just all dove in and got it done. There are all kinds of stories about these things. I remember one time I didn't want to spend any money on motels. So we all slept in sleeping bags on the floor of one of our guys' houses. His furniture hadn't gotten there yet. Fair old Arend made a big difference in the early rollout of Walmart's. He was a very organized person in a way that I wasn't. I always told him it was because he was German, but he was the kind of fellow who, if he had 10 things to do in a day, would write them all down and then work to get them done. He would double back to see that people did what he told them to do. I never did that as a rule in those days. I just kept moving. I think a powerful sense of needing to take off to the next town or the next store when I'm ready, without wasting any time waiting on somebody else, is probably the main reason I never was able to work real well with pilots. It seemed like they were never ready to go when I was. Anyway, I love the flying, the challenge of finding my way all over the country, evaluating the weather and making the instrument approaches, and doing everything myself. But even more than that, I love the independence of being able to go where I want to, when I want to, in a hurry. Plus, I always like to see people working, and the nature of a corporate pilot's job includes a lot of downtime. So when we first got a few pilots around here, I conceived this brilliant idea. "Okay, guys," I said, "if you want to fly airplanes, I want you to go into the stores and check on our in-stock positions in all our departments when you aren't flying." It made perfect sense to me. They needed to learn more about the business. They would be helping us, and they could have had some fun with it. My idea lasted about 3 months and provoked all kinds of grumbling. I heard every excuse in the book. "We've got to check the weather and make sure the planes are taken care of," and all that. Finally, I gave in. And today, our pilots stay in the air about as much as anybody in their business. Jack Shoemaker. The first store we opened after I got there was number 21 in St. Robert, Missouri. Our store opening crew was supposed to take possession of a store after construction was complete. It didn't always work out that way. When we took that store, the parking lot wasn't done. I mean, it was gravel and had no striping, no cording of cars or anything. So the store manager, Gary Reinboth, and I were trying to figure out how to avoid chaos at the opening. Our eyes lit up when we saw this snack bar vendor hauling used cooking grease in these huge yellow barrels in the back of his truck. So we made a deal with him. He could buy all our grease at a good price if we could have all his grease barrels for the grand opening. We tied flags and rope on them and made a parking lot. That's the way we thought in those days. Sam wanted a job done, and he was willing to accept creativity as long as the job got done. Our minds were freewheeling. We rushed to get things done. I remember another opening. We had finally built a new store in Marlton, Arkansas, out near Interstate 40, to replace that incredible store Sam was so proud of in the old Coca-Cola plant. My boss was Farrell Arend, and he told me we were going to set a new record of opening a store in 3 weeks. I said, okay. But he had made a mistake by a week, so we really had a target date of 2 weeks from the day we began. We tried desperately, but we didn't quite make it. We opened on Thanksgiving Day, and the store was horrible. I was standing out in front when Sam drove up. He saw the disaster, but he was smart enough to know how hard we'd been working, and that if he told the truth, we would have just disintegrated. He said, "The store looks really good, guys," and he drove away and left us. Obviously, because I have spent as much time as I could out where it counts, in the stores, seeing if we're doing the job we should be, it has put a very heavy load on all our executives, especially since I expect them to get out in the stores, too. My style has always been to lay off a lot of the day-to-day operating responsibilities to folks like Farrell Arendt and Ron Mayer in the early days, later on to Jack Shoemaker, and eventually to David Glass and Don Soderquist. So my role has been to pick good people and give them the maximum authority and responsibility. I've been asked if I was a hands-on manager or an arm's-length type. I think really I'm more of a manager by walking and flying around. And in the process, I stick my fingers into everything I can to see how it's coming along. I've let our executives make their decisions and their mistakes, but I've critiqued and advised them. My appreciation for numbers has kept me close to our operational statements and to all the other information we have pouring in from so many different places. In that sense, I think my style as an executive has been pretty much dictated by my talents. I've played to my strengths and relied on others to make up for my weaknesses. As I mentioned, I found out early that one of my talents is remembering numbers. I can't recall names and a lot of other things as well as I'd like to. but numbers just stick with me and always have. That's why I come in every Saturday morning, usually around 2 or 3, and go through all the weekly numbers. I steal the march on everybody else for the Saturday morning meeting. I can go through those sheets and look at a store, and even though I haven't been there in a while, I can remind myself of something about it, the manager maybe. And then I can remember later that they are doing this much business this week, and that their wage cost is such and such. I do this with each store every Saturday morning. It usually takes about 3 hours, but when I'm done, I have as good a feel for what's going on in the company